Welcome to the ANews Podcast. This is episode 12 for May 20th, 2017. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week, mostly from North America. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. On Our Minds This Week. On Our Minds This Week is the release of Chelsea Manning. I have no idea whether she is sympathetic to anarchist ideas or not, but the gorgeous image she released of her new post-prison and post-transition face felt like something special, something magical. We wish her well in her new post-prison life, and wish for the abolition of prisons and the kind of thinking that builds them. Editorial. Balkanization. I did not look back at some glorious era when all anarchists I knew used to associate with each other and like one another. Not the Spanish Civil War, not Paris in 68, and not some imaginary 1990s before the anti-globalization movement shattered us. I don't believe it ever existed, nor do I recall anything like it in my life. My early years of association with anarchists would have chased me away if I wasn't very stubborn. The first anarchists I met seemed to delight in how much more they knew than me and how much cooler they were than me. They even had a clubhouse next door to the cafe I worked at, and the door was mostly kept closed. This is not a call for a false unity under the Cercle de flag. We, the myriad of factions and approaches, do not have a shared project that we should sacrifice ourselves for, but, and of course I can already hear the snickers in the back of the room, the breathlessness with which we attempt to destroy, or at least talk shit, about other people's projects has reached the point where we should recognize it for what it is. Bullshit. I know that ANews is represented as being against other projects, and in fact, came into existence to respond to a lack we saw in the past generation of anarchist website projects. We fully understand that a new generation coming into its power is going to do the same thing with ANews. Nothing but respect as far as that goes. Other projects help us center ourselves along the lines of helping us re-examine what our project is doing well and not doing well. Other projects can also be collaborators and allies. What other anarchist projects are not are separate islands. They are not unrecognizable. They are not enemies. As soon as an anarchist project frames things in this kind of way, it's important to call it out. We may disagree on tactical and strategic points, but we are not enemies. Let's leave this kind of nonsense to the capitalists and statists. Hell, let's leave this kind of infighting to the commies and liberals who famously spend all of their time fighting each other and not their declared enemies. We agree on who the enemy is. We may not agree on what the best way, timing, or ferocity with which to fight them, but we absolutely agree that the duopoly of state and capital come first. We also mostly agree on the color of our flag, black. If we aren't going to collaborate or be friendly, it makes the most sense to ignore each other instead of making that impossible. This is my thought on the question of balkanization. If it is not in fact a question, but a matter of reality that I hold in opposition to a new school anarchist view that holds that their position is correct and let a thousand splinters fly, then I will sadly be counted among history. I will state that against fracture, that the word, and even the black flag, means something worth fighting for, and worth repulsing those who think their temporary issues are greater than 150 years of the beautiful idea. What's new this week? There is nothing anarchist about eco-fascism, a condemnation of ITS. Scott Campbell from IGD posts this piece that not only condemns ITS, but also some anarchist projects in the US that publish information by ITS. Quote, "So do we anarchists give attention to them? Admittedly, even the existence of this piece is a capitulation to their attention seeking. But worse are those that promote, even implicitly, the actions of ITS. Sites such as Anarchist News, Free Radical Radio, ATASA, Little Black Heart, and Black Powder Press. The "a retweet does not constitute endorsement" excuse doesn't fly here. As ITS says, "We've been warning you since the beginning." And now they are claiming to have killed 3 humans simply because they were human. Will ITS fans continue to distribute the propaganda of a group that, by its own admission, is not only not anarchist, but proudly terroristic? Rejecting of all ethics, morals, or principles of liberation? They solely exist to kill people. It should not have to be explained why such a position does not merit support. Of a less pressing matter is the way in which ITS conceives of nature itself as a social and civilization construct. Their, and already constantly shifting, ideological basis for murder falls apart under any real scrutiny." End quote.
On the IGD PSA, atasa.wordpress.com responds to the preceding IGD article with a point-by-point refutation, clarifying some things, and rejecting some assumptions. In response to the point quoted above, the ATASA contributor says, quote, "Yes, poor Mexico, tan te lejos de Dios, ah hell, you know the rest. How dare these people be disloyal to their poor, suffering country? They should show more patriotism instead of saying stuff like this." Quoting Wild Reaction, "You know, Mexico is a steaming pile of shit. It's conflicted, corrupt, and prostituted to the highest bidder, treacherous, run down, and even though there are people who say that they are good things about it, we see more bad things than good, to be honest. Really, we can't even know if there is a person who was imprisoned in that maximum security prison and who escaped was actually Chapo Guzman or an imposter. That's for starters. Lies piled upon lies are daily fare here. Personally, I don't trust anything that the media blabbers about. Every one of them is blowing shit out of their ass. That there is a low-intensity war going on, that's for sure. But you can speak of this, just not in terms of narco-trafficking. There are also groups, politicians, private interests, etc." End of Wild Reaction quote. Comrade, how dare they fail in their loyalty to the glorious fatherland? Death to the Yankee imperialism. The beatings will continue more until morale improves. Unquote.
Now, the Invisible Committee. From autonomies.org, quote, "A space for the intrinsic defense of freedom and equality," unquote. This is the translation of the first chapter of 7 from the Invisible Committee's newest book, Montenant, or in English, Now. Quote, "All the reasons for carrying out a revolution are present. None is missing. The sinking of politics, the arrogance of the powerful, the reign of the false, the vulgarity of the wealthy, the cataclysms of industry, rampant poverty, naked exploitation, ecological apocalypse. We are spared nothing, not even that of being informed. Climate 2016 breaks the record of heat, tells us Le Monde on its first page, as almost every year nowadays. All the reasons are united, but it's not reasons that make revolutions. It is bodies, and the bodies are all in front of screens." Unquote.
1917, an anti-war revolution. From Bordered by Silence, a website of translated radical texts. Quote, translator, text from the April 2017 issue of Canon's Rompus, a revolutionary anti-war journal published in France. Not tied to a specific ideology, this journal engages a critique of the state by analyzing the role of the military in politics, society, and the economy. This text is interesting in that, departing somewhat from their usual anti-war stance, it appears to say that the Russian withdrawal from World War I represented an abandonment of internationalist principles and led to the consolidation of the Leninist, quote, "revolutions are the internal business of states" ideology that continues to operate today in the pro-Assad opposition to the Syrian revolution, for instance. From Cannon's Rumpus. Exactly 100 years ago, in March 1917, the Russian Revolution began. This revolution, led primarily by farmers, workers, and soldiers, set off a worldwide revolutionary wave and kept the working class's hopes alive for decades. We want to draw attention to the role played by war in sparking the revolution and in its continuation, as well as on the importance of the questions of peace starting in the first street demonstrations. Unquote.
The 8th Annual Anarchist Book Fair in Mexico City is happening May 27th and 28th. The announcement of the Mexico City Anarchist Book Fair, including many workshops, mostly on Saturday, with topics from poetry to sabbat, or sabbate, to Venezuela.
There will be blood. Gelderloos on healthcare, tax cuts, and Trump. From IGD, Gelderloos continues his periodic chats about current events. In this case, overwhelmingly about Trump and the spectacle of the White House. Quote, and this brings us back to why some of us have been saying from the beginning that the Trump administration does not represent a real threat of dictatorship, and of fascism even less so. Here's an example of Trump's dictatorial leadership style. Require constant proofs of loyalty from your subordinates, and pit them in constant conflict against one another. As Ana Arende and others have pointed out, in a dictatorship, institutions are actually less defined, less firmly rooted, and in constant competition for the favors of the dictator. That turns out to be Trump's ideal. But what happens when you take an executive administration with a dictatorial leadership ideal and you put it at the head of a thoroughly democratic state? You get an ineffective administration that is unable to push its program through, even with its own party. And you get a backlash from the other branches of government, doubling down on democratic values. Unquote.
Also from IGD, Peak Sieve, a dino chicken in every pot. This is the latest Kevin Tucker column. Quote, the Tasmanian tiger, the ivory-billed woodpecker, they're not here for us, but they are a reminder that we don't need to wait for permission to live. The resilience of the wild is refusal to be controlled. There is no guarantee or safety within it, but there is a chance of survival, of living on our own terms. At a certain point, you just have to stop asking. End quote.
New photos of Jeremy. Photos of Jeremy Hammond and announcement as to his well-being. It's nice to hear and see that he's holding up. Quote, I've spoken with numerous people who have served time with Jeremy, both in New York and in Manchester, and they assure me that Jeremy is well-liked by his fellow inmates. Jeremy himself tells me that he is doing well, that there is no news to speak of, really, and that he appreciates the letters, books, and articles that people send him. If you haven't written to Jeremy in a while, now is a great time. Click here to see how you can write, and always remember that we still rely on donations for Jeremy's commissary. Unquote. Remember, support our prisoners.
Clashes in Athens and Thessaloniki as the parliament votes for more austerity. Quote, shortly before parliament voted on a new round of austerity measures, a group of anarchists tried to enter parliament. They climbed the stairs towards the parliament building. Like the day before, short but intense clashes broke out. Riot cops prevented the anarchists from reaching parliament, but were attacked with Molotov cocktails. Black bloc activists set one of the EV zone's guard posts in front of parliament on fire. The EV zones are guards on 24-hour basis in front of the monument of the unknown soldier. Cops arrested at least one person and detained two. According to the cops, they were found to be in possession of a hammer and an axe. During similar protests in Thessaloniki, people beat a cop and set his motorcycle on fire. A flag of the European Union was set on fire also.
John Zerzan seems to have no fucking clue what nihilism means. This is a post from the Post-Proletariat site, by someone who has clearly been listening to Zerzan's podcast / radio show for long enough to get frustrated by Zerzan's latest target of choice, nihilists. The post goes through various definitions of nihilists. There are probably even more. This is a quotation from nihilistcommunism.toblog. Quote, "In lurches and flashes, I recognize both my disconnection from and the integration within social production. I am in no position to contribute to, participate in, or take control over the processes that form me. I am in no position to prevent, slow down, or halt the environment that constrains and uses me. I am a character, not an actor. Sometimes, as in a dream, I become aware that my presence, my behavior, my words are written and directed from elsewhere. Sometimes, I become sufficiently aware of the field of my determinations, and I make inky scratches upon myself as a reminder of my vanities. The condition of my defeat, which is also a mode of minimal preservation, and which I permanently inhabit, appears as a frozen act of self-interruption, or a prolonged stay of execution. I am stopped here, at some border, and I will not cross it, nor will I turn back. I seem to have been waiting for a very long time for the world to close over me." Unquote.
Media projects. No Canada, looking for contributors and co-conspirators. A call out for participating in actions in media against Canada Day. Quote, "No Canada is a collaborative project between anarchists and radicals across Turtle Island to counter celebrations of the 150th anniversary of the Canadian state, taking place in 2017. Through a bilingual website, zine, mixtape, and countrywide print and social media promotional campaign, the project aims to disrupt the papering over of Canada's history and current practices. Beyond critical articles, the website will direct users to things actually worth celebrating and taking part in: Indigenous-led land defense, resistance to Canadian mining corporations, as well as current struggles against borders, war, and prisons. The website will go live a week before Canada Day, July 1st. End quote.
Introducing thebreadbook.org. This is a website that seems to exist entirely for the purpose of introducing and offering a link to download Kropotkin's Conquest of Bread, which is a fine read. Perhaps someone will also do this for Sasha Berkman's prison memoirs. Quote, "Kropotkin offers solutions to many of the problems we are facing in the 21st century, from food and job insecurity to homelessness to general malaise and depression. Many of the problems we face as a society can be addressed if we work together. We believe that community-focused ideas should be part of the conversation, especially in the face of authoritarian, state-sponsored solutions. If you care about solving some of these problems, and you want to have a broader perspective on what is possible, keep reading."
Introduction to a book by anarchists from Aleppo. From translation by Bordered by Silence. This is an announcement of a new book and the introduction from that book. Quote, "Fundamentally, the experiences and analysis that we gained through our encounters cannot be separated from the fact of being on the losing side. So many of our problems were linked to the lack of solutions or hypotheses, with the full weight of the situation being down to our imaginations. We call for our readers to not remain oblivious to the problems mentioned in the text. Without claiming to have the full truth, we can teach certain lessons to comrades who are in solidarity with our ongoing struggle against all authoritarian power. This account doesn't stray far from the limits of our experience and the decisions we made with all their errors and flaws." Unquote. This thread also has an interesting comment from Anonymous, quote, "It's true this text is unusually self-critical, looking at who was empowered to produce revolutionary theory, produce blind spots around certain forms of domination that Islamicists were able to exploit and seize control of much of the movement. But to imply that there haven't been fierce critiques of Islamicists coming out since at least 2012 just isn't true. And there were Syrian radicals getting locked up for critiquing Islamicists since at least 2008. It was undercutting the Ba'athists' anti-imperialist creed. They're widely described as counter-revolutionary forces by almost all of the pro-revolution groups." End quote.
Podcasts. The Anarchist Podcast number 8 Firefest, Mayday, and Violence. This podcast has a terrible name, and they should change it. Aside from that editorial comment, Chelsea Manning is our hero. The Ja Rules fiasco is worth at least 5 minutes. No, make that 15. Short report backs on the Mayday events that varied depending on location. Campuses as the terrain for fights against the alt-right. Some interesting articles about what kind of fighting is strategic against the alt-right, and some practical considerations about street fighting. Is exercising violence inherently hierarchical? This podcast continues to be a solid voice for leftist anarchists, despite the efforts of Rebel.
Free Radical Radio audiobooks, ITS Communiques 3, 4, and Buffo the Clown. They can't stop, they won't stop. Quote, there has been exactly one important thing published in response to our first release of ITS Communique 1, 2. Maudition Eco-Extremista, linked to the release, provided a brief history of the evolution of ITS. Atassa then translated it to English. I suggest you read it, as it's very useful to put these early communiques into the present context. Like you and I, ITS hasn't a static position or identity. End quote.
TFS Radio, Anarchy in Portugal with Silvia and Mario. This episode starts out with information on anarchist prisoners and events and some local struggles against a newly identified hate group. Long-term anarchist prisoner Sean Swain talks about a Palestinian prison hunger strike in Israel. The rest of the episode is a talk with two anarchists from Lisbon, Portugal. Quote, Silvia and Mario give a history of anarchism since the fascist dictatorship in 1926 under Antonio Salazar through 1974, when the government fell, and since. Silvia and Mario are involved in a workers' library founded during the dictatorship that was taken over by anarchists in the 1990s and has continued and shares space with a bookstore and social center called Tortuga and sits atop a DIY music venue. Unquote.
Anarchy Radio, 5/16/2017, Catherine co-hosts, discussion of accelerationism, nihilist and egoist anarchists don't understand how they're just replicating normal social tendencies, free radical radio is bad for reading ITS communiques, ITS is just like snuff films for teenage boys, better not to pay attention to things we don't like, the Invisible Committee's Tomorrow is Canceled article, end quote. People just need a little thinking, a little analysis, end quote. Strange. Minor action news, algae blooms, cholera, Ebola, and more.
The Idiotic Episode 2.0. Like the Brilliant, any project named The Idiotic must have a sense of humor, so thumbs up for that. This podcast is three people pretty much agreeing with each other about things like the article Between Insurrection and the Commune, posted on A-News on May 9th, 2017, pigeonholed as an anti-tikkun, pro-Bookchin, jargon-filled, and empty piece. The idea of community versus neighborhood also promoting actions that worked in one place as if place and localized history is irrelevant. Cited, Armed Joy, Monsieur Dupont, Politics is Not a Banana, Wolfie, Anarchy, A Journal of Desire Armed, Freddie Perlman. These folks seem like readers. Not eating during recording might be a good idea in the future. There's also a kind of a lot of talking over each other. Seems like they are all pro-communism. Moving on to whether the Black Bloc is and should be scary, one person says that there's no question that Black Bloc is a good tactic because, quote, lives are on the line. Portland won the Mayday competition for highest amount of property damage, and a couple approvingly quote Mao, which is a bit startling. A lot of discussion about what it means to take a gun to a protest, as exemplified by the Austin Mayday. Going to bars to build a movement versus not being Jehovah's Witnesses ends quite abruptly, but is an hour and a half.
Topic of the week, responses to intimate violence. Intimate violence is something that occurs within any community, and among anarchists in general, there has been a long-running attempt to define and resolve it in a way that is supposed to reflect our politics. Tools such as call-out and accountability processes were adopted and developed with the intent of countering a culture in which intimate violence is denied, hidden, or thrown back at the person claiming to have been wronged. In their better forms, these practices contextualize intimate violence as not just a bad thing that some bad individuals do, but in part the product of social roles we occupy, aimed to create a more holistic culture in which those classified as abused and abuser would emerge from their experience better with the participation and support of the larger community. Unfortunately, the actual practices around these ideas have fallen far short of that vision, if they had it to begin with. Writings such as The Broken Teapot, For Your Safety and Security, and The Politics of Denunciation, among others, have detailed ways in which certain popular practices of safe space and accountability have created eternal victims and sinners. Social contexts in which narratives around abuse have to meet certain rhetorical and moral criteria to be honored at all. And a concept of justice that looks an awful lot like that of society in general. The failure of accountability and the toxic culture around it has been especially evident to me as I have witnessed firsthand. If we consider that intimate violence is still an issue relevant for anarchists to deal with, where does this leave us? What are your experiences with responses to intimate violence among anarchists, or as an anarchist, among non-anarchists? What's the response to this issue that's in line with your concept of anarchy? And joining me to discuss this week is John Henry.
Well, this is a very interesting subject to me. I like a lot of the things described in that intro because I feel like that already starts to shine a light on the complexity and the problems of it. I mean, I've known you. I've been a part of the anarchist milieu for about 20 years now, so I can literally think of examples of almost, you know, viewing this from every single angle possible. I've had friends who were wrongly accused of sexual assault and then, you know, watched the witch hunt form around them. I've had friends who were victims of sexual assault, or for lack of a better word, recipients of attacks and who wanted a meaningful response. I've been attacked myself and had friends rally around me and had to sort of parse out, you know, the degree to which retribution was appropriate. I've been a part of witch hunts against people who were accused. It's a mess. And so I've had a long time to think about these things, and there's so very much to think about.
Okay. What do you think?
I mean, I don't have any concrete solutions, but I know the pitfalls, and I see a lot of the dangers of it. Of course, it's essential that we figure out a way to deal with these problems without having to rely on the state, or even the sort of judicial mentality, I would say. It's essential. It's a terrible problem. People are getting attacked, and we have to have a effective, you know, way of dealing with that.
It does seem like the magical thinking at the heart of this topic is the idea that if somebody is hurt, which, you know, largely we're responding to our friends a victim being hurt, that if someone is hurt, that somehow through some process, through something, that they're going to somehow not be hurt at the end of that process. And I think that, to me, that feels like the first part that has to be addressed in a blunter way than is being addressed currently. In other words, if someone hurts you, they have hurt you. That is something you will have to live with moving forward. And even if they, you know, go through a 10-step program and end up having to talk to everybody about the hurt that they did you, that's, for lack of better language, that's part of life, and healing is part of life. And this brings up a very common sort of, I guess, argument, which is that it's a privileged position to basically say that damage happens and that people need to learn to heal as much as they need to learn to retribute and whatever. And so I think a lot of people listening to this will immediately ask the question, how does one stop the culture of intimate violence? Whereas the way in which this particular question is framed, it's framed much more like the intimate violence happens, full stop. And that's the question that I don't have an answer to, which is how to stop something before it happens in a total recall.
Yeah, I mean, there's I think the framing people as, like it says in the intro, framing people as abused versus perpetrator, you know, using that language is the first place where things seem to go wrong. I think if people are part of a community or part of a scene.
Well, just to interrupt, yeah. Do you have an example of a situation you were in where that language was abandoned early on and there were perhaps better results?
Not better results, but definitely abandoned. I mean, I had a good friend who came to a group of us and at one point said that a mutual friend that we all knew had raped her while they'd been drinking. And we were outraged, appalled, and disgusted. We immediately rallied and thought, you know, we're going to move in on this guy. You know, we're going to take care of this situation in a sort of a heroic machismo kind of way. I suppose that definitely was an element of that. And we were literally at one point getting in the car to go beat this dude down. And the person who had been the receiver, the one who said she'd been raped, said, well, hold on a minute, hold on a second. Maybe rape is too strong of a word to use. You know, that it was complicated. I didn't actually speak up as much as I should have, although it should have been obvious that I didn't want to do what we were doing. So we had to stop completely. You know, it was suddenly I was confronted with the fact that I still wanted to beat this dude down. And then I realized I actually don't like this guy for other reasons, mm-hmm. related
right.
reasons, you know.
Right.
He was a womanizer, to use a popular term, and that was absolutely true of him. But does that deserve a beatdown? Versus, did I want to beat him down for the rape?
Sure.
Did I want to beat him down because I didn't like him because of how he was chauvinistic towards women that I cared about? But I was suddenly confronted with the contradictions of my own impulse to go and beat this guy down, which I initially felt was purely righteous and the thing to do. So it started falling apart pretty fast after that. And then the more we pursued it, the more we interrogated the situation and talked to everyone involved, the more messy it got. That person wound up removing himself, which is a solution for my immediate circle of friends, but where that person went and whether or not they continued those ugly habits, I cannot speak to that. So maybe someone just inherited our problem because we drove them out. So I don't call that a solution in the larger sense, but...
And again, you know... To talk about this from the different perspective, I feel like some other people who would have been in doing this topic of the week with me did not want to do it because they liked the idea of two men having this conversation.
Sure.
And the one thing that I do think is common in this moment is how does one parse the victim should be driving this conversation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't love that language, but. But if someone has been injured, they should be driving the conversation about what's to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to not actually be the case. I mean, in my own experience, in one of the more dramatic instances in which I was involved, the person who was injured immediately lost agency in the entire situation. And a group of friends, a social circle, a clique, took up the torch on this person's behalf, representing this person's injury. And of course, that's not appropriate. But this person never would have done anything at all. And I think that's a very common scenario where agency basically gets stripped from the victim now twice, on the one hand, but then if it were left to their own devices, you know, individual people are very easy to isolate and to be gaslit and to be made to feel foolish or stupid or to change their minds.
Right.
And so in this way, this whole conversation, you know, becomes triply problematic, which I guess turns me to the conversation of saying this conversation is about what your vision of what anarchism should be is. Because for a lot of people, anarchism is a series of people who want to be left alone.
Yeah.
Individualism.
Mm.
Other people see anarchism as a series of overlapping social groups that are naturally going to be in conflict with each other because of indignities, injuries, and more.
Right.
And to speak for myself rather than for other people, I wish for anarchism to be a very loosely knit community where we know each other's names, but we're not necessarily in each other's business. and where things like intimate violence is something that is known broadly. In other words, we have names and we have histories mm-hmm. and memories of each other. And I feel like one of the things that's happened in the past decade has been that we have started to lose the names of other anarchists, and whatever loose social relationships we've had with each other seem to be dissipating.
I mean, I feel like in a way that's, of course, a terrible thing. And yet there's like, in a way, I've also, a lot of the problems I described in the earlier scenario is that we were too much in each other's business. We wanted our vision of being radical punk house, a bunch of anarchists living together, was to be so in each other's business that the witch hunt scenario I just described mm-hmm. was possible, not only possible, but kind of inevitable in a way. You know, whereas to contrast that with something you said, you know, I about a couple of years after the event I just described, I was in a different social context with anarchist radical folks, a group house, and there was a couple who had a lot of violence between them, violence in the sense that they would scream bloody murder at each other when they fought and would hurl objects. So, like, you know, from the other room, you heard shattering things, screaming, thumping, and banging. But afterward, they always emerged, and while there was a cooling off period, they both were okay with that. And so the rest of us in the house were sort of forced to kind of go, it's not really our business. You know, she's not afraid of him 2 hours later. He doesn't want to, he's not afraid of her, even though they hurled potted plants at each other 2 hours ago. So there was this kind of feeling of like, we should give them, it's none of our business. So it's, whereas now, I agree with you, the context is more, so much happens online. We're so removed. The population is mobile in this way, chasing jobs and other things. And we're just out of each other's business in a way that is sad, but also kind of, there's a distance there that, I don't know, I don't find myself getting involved in these dramas. I mean, I could tell you 10 stories that are similar to the ones that I've already told you from my 20s, and I don't really have hardly any stories from the last decade of my life, for example. And I still know all the same people. I'm still friends with most of those same people. It's just, life is different now. You know what I mean?
Well, or to put it a different way, as you age, these topics seem to fade from view as being the most important thing to think about and talk about and experience.
They do, yeah.
I mean, your life is not as dramatic as it was in your 20s.
Exactly. Nor are my friends' lives. So,
yeah, I mean, not to totally transition the conversation and we'll return as we conclude, but an anarchist in their 40s doesn't talk about intimate violence as much as an anarchist in their 20s.
Yeah, it's true. It does not come up. There's other things. And I'm glad that's the case. And I'm glad that I'm not... These things were really heartbreaking and, you know, nightmarish to deal with in a lot of ways. And I'm glad they're happening less. You know, it's a scary thought to think that they're still happening, but maybe aren't being addressed, or are the people that are experiencing them are more isolated and therefore sort of cut off from
mm-hmm, absolutely.
Solutions that would be useful to them, or just support from friends and people. But it's a mixed. It's mixed. It's definitely there's like benefits, and then there's drawbacks to this new mode. I am in a new mode for sure. I'm in a long-term stable relationship that. And as are most of my friends, or they're just sort of, they're single and they're just free of that kind of drama. They're old enough now that they can sort of see that drama on the horizon and sidestep it much more easily than people in their 20s that I was able to do in my 20s. I never saw it coming until it was right in front of me.
I mean, I'll also say that I'm not sure that 20 years ago, a zine like The Broken Teapot would have made as much of an impact, or maybe even could have been written. In other words, a broader category of our friends or potential friends are smarter than they were in the past. And, you know, perhaps a lot of the IV conversation, intimate violence conversation that used to happen, is now the ways in which people talk about having experiences and being experienced people, you know, rather than being traumatized people and just experiencing trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not, of course, to say that these incidences are appropriate, or, you know, that we wouldn't love to live in a world where they didn't exist, but people's coping skills, I think, perhaps are better than they used to be.
I totally agree. I mean, I see that for sure. Like, for example, I'll give you two examples. I mean, all my friends and peers, you know, growing up, we all watched, most of everyone that I know from my generation, who I'm close with, saw intimate violence with their parents and their parents' friends, came from broken homes, divorces, shattered relationships. And so our generation emerged from that experience of childhood much more cautious. We were slower to get into relationships. We were more careful. We talked way more about it before we did get into relationships. However, for us, polyamory was almost impossible. I mean, I remember that was an idea that came up a lot in the anarchist circles that I was in. And it was just like this conundrum that nobody could get their head around. Whereas people I know now that are in relationships and they're in their 20s, early 30s, they can do polyamory in a way that me and my peers were just like, we couldn't do it. Yeah. So there is a kind of like, there's an undeniable experience is accumulating, and that is having an effect. The younger generation is more savvy. There's no doubt.
Well, there's definitely something about queerness that has enabled polyamory in a way that not queerness has not. And
agreed.
A lot of kids who are thinking about queerness are not thinking about it in a radical political scene. They're thinking about it more or less immediately after puberty.
And yeah.
They're talking about queerness in high school. That is a huge change.
Yep, that was not my experience.
Yeah, I will say, though, that by way of closing, we're talking about in real life, face-to-face experiences. I think that we could have spent this entire time criticizing the way in which people behave with each other around this exact same topic if we were just talking about the internet and the way in which people do it online.
Yep.
Because I think that the internet is a cesspool for this.
I agree.
And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The weekly Anarchy 101 question and some answers. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org. This is a user-moderated question and answer site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. It has nearly a decade of questions and answers. This week, the question is, why do some anarchists say they're anti-anarchism? They make a big deal about anarchism, I guess instead of saying anarchist ideas. I don't get it. Answer number one. The idea is that any set of ideas can get frozen and become more of a problem than a help. As an example of this tendency in common language, people talk about abiding by the letter of the law instead of the spirit of the law. And here's that same concern, that people have stopped paying attention to what is important and are focusing on the most superficial indicators. Another example is the Bruce Lee movie, where he is schooling a student and points to the moon. The student looks at his finger and gets chastised for not looking at the moon in all its heavenly glory. People who talk about this usually use the word ideology as a problem, i.e. defining ideology as frozen ideas, and refer to anything ending with ism as an indication that that freezing has happened. Answer number two. Bob Black and others make the distinction of anarchism versus anarchy, anarchism being a set of theories, whether left anarchism or anarchism more broadly, whereas anarchy is the lived experience outside of or despite authority. This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel, written by Jackie, narrated by Aragorn Chisel and John Henry. And we thank John Henry for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist material at littleblackcart.com, news and up-to-the-minute commentary at anarchistnews.org.